We went last time we saw this little demonstration at the polymorphism. I showed you why we want to use templates just to avoid to write everything by hand. And then I went very briefly at the end through the basics. So the take home message from the third point was basically if you use templates, do it in headers rather than in CPP files. Yeah, if the compile time really goes up, like 1 minute compile time, put it in a CPP file just to work with, like until you have a release version, and then in the end for the release version you like compile everything again. So yeah, it's possible to put the stuff in the O files, but then you need this explicit instantiation that I talked about. The points that we have still to go through is this mean trait. That's this general mean function that I showed you in the demonstration. In this part, you will pick up all the nice techniques. Then Sphene and pitfalls and concept programming are the points remaining. I will start off, and again, yeah, the repository is here. I updated some code. There is also folder 8 with a summary is also in there now. And again, if you don't get anything, please ask questions. First, I just briefly go through the stuff we did last time. Type def, you use it like this. You just type def, and then the type you want to like have, for example, a shorter version because int is such a long name, so we probably want to type I instead of int. Where it's sensible is like if we have a standard vector of a standard vector of an integer, and we don't always want to type the standard vector of standard vector, we can just type def this to an int array. And now, what if you wanted like a type def where you don't have to insert int? So you basically want to call array type of int, and what you want to have is standard vector of int. That works, but only with the new standard. It also works in the old standard, but you had to use a workaround. And with the new standard, it looks different, but this basically is a new style type def. So it's used with the keyword using and not with type def anymore, but it's basically the same thing. So don't like mix them up or think of using namespaces. It doesn't have to do anything with, you also do like this using namespace stuff. But this is really, you have to think of this like a type def. And so basically, this is just a template that says, well, I want to call my array type, and it has to be this standard vector of t. And then in the end, how you call it, you can just call now your type def as you would an integer. Just we have a variable number one of type e, I, what's an integer. Here we have the int array. And for the array type, we need to get to hand the template parameter, right? And then, yeah, you use it basically as you would normally. And the second reason for type defs is to like make your code more flexible and readable. Here I type def an int to a spin type because I represent, for example, my spin with an integer. And I mean, if you see something like this in a code, int a1, it could be really anything. It could be like an index or an incrementer or whatever, a counter. So you have no clue what it is. So the way without type def would be you like put the name or the function of the variable, you put it in the name, like here spin a1. But it tends to you tend to end up with longer names, and it's quite cumbersome to write all these long names all the time. And especially since you need the type only once and the name you need multiple times. So that's why, and that's just for readability. I mean, using type def has this really awesome effect that you can just change the integer up there. You can just change this integer to a double if you want to change your spin representation or whatever. And you cannot do that if you use integer here hard-coded.
Does A2 ever know that it's spin type rather than just an int?
Nope. It's exactly the same.
No, but when, like in debugging or in error checking, would anything...
No, if I do... Funny. If I do type ID, I'll show you in a second what it is, of A1, this basically will tell me that it's an integer. No, it doesn't know anything. It's like an alias or a macro that you put it there. You want to name it other. It's just for you as a programmer. I'm not sure. I don't think that you can retrieve spin type in any way. Or I've never seen it done. And you can. It's basically exactly. It behaves exactly the same as an integer. But in the end, you have some code, and for the readability, if you have something like this or whatever, and the user doesn't know what A1 and A2 is, normally the first thing you do is you go to the declaration of the variable, right? And then you see something like this, spin type A2, and then you know, it has to do something with spins. That's why type defs are used. Then the next point, I wasn't quite 100% happy how I explained it last time, is the word type name. And so I have like a better version now. First of all, we need it here in the template, just to tell that it's a template. And again, you could also write class T, it's exactly equivalent to type name. But class T seems a bit odd because if you pass an integer, I mean, it will accept it, but an integer is not a class, but it will still work. I mean, you can like get rid of type name and put in class, works perfectly fine. But that's why we type name basically just says the next thing that comes is a type. And that's why you use it here in a template. Yeah, but don't like freak out if you see something like this. I mean, it's perfectly legal.
An integer is a class. It's just fundamental.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have to be a class. It's just a placeholder for a type. But as again, it seems just odd to place class there because you can put in an integer. And the second like usage for type name is to retrieve type. So basically, this first template, it just type defs T to type. It doesn't do anything fancy. And my second template here, it just gets the type from the first template here. It goes and takes this T out of this first template. And you need, so this is basically the type that we type def to second type. And you need this type name here because you have a dependent scope. This guy here, before the scope, it depends on T. If I were to write int here, you can get rid of type name. So just the take-home message for this is just, as soon as you see a pattern like this, something, blah, 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 T, whatever, scope, a type, you need type name, just for the compiler. And if the type is known, you don't need it. I didn't explain that really properly. So here it's fine. I don't need type name here because everything is known. And I also don't need type name down here because it just all is known, right? I mean, I have integer, it's something concrete and it's instantiated. So that's just a side remark for type name and everything works. Any questions so far? Then the third thing that we are going to use today, or just in general that it's good to know, is this sizeof and type ID. Sizeof is a really, it's also a reserved keyword as well as type ID. You cannot like have variables with those names. You probably can have a variable that is called type ID if you don't include this type info header, but I never tried that. So sizeof gives you the numbers of bytes that the type needs. So if we have the size of int, it gives me back 4 because an int normally, or at least on my machine, it has 4 bytes, so 32-bit integer. And a double is 8 byte and so on. And you can either insert a type like this, or you can insert an object of a type. So either is fine. And if we just run this, we can see here we have 4 and 4. This is the size of the integer. And you will see me using this sizeof function quite a lot if we do meta template programming, because the nice thing about this function is it takes a type and it maps it to a number. And it's unique in that way because you can feed it, you can feed types, you can convert types to numbers. And the second one is type ID. You need the type info header for that. But the compiler will tell you if you don't include it. You'll know. And
I thought you needed ionInit for size of. Is that an old standard?
I'm not sure if ionInit.
LStream probably has a lot of overlap.
Yeah, but ionInit doesn't have, or at least of my knowledge, it doesn't have ionInit in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can look it up, but I think it works. It somehow it comes from iostream. One of those probably gets, or perhaps type info has it. But I think it just works via iostream.
Yeah.
So type ID just also takes a type or an object, and it gives you, so basically this thing here is an actual object that has information about the type. And one feature of this object is, for example, name. And the name is just this I. You see this last one in red? This is my custom, one of my types. And there you have way more information, and I'll show you just how it works. Down here I have type ID of namespace example, scope, then my struct, and that's the template, and it takes integer as a parameter. It just looks like this here. It's a really simple template in the namespace example. And you see here it says n for namespace, then 7, that just means now seven characters follow. And then it says example, and then it says 9 characters follow my struct. And then this, between the I and the two E's, are just the template parameters that I gave. So here I have an I because I chose an I. And yeah, so that's quite handy, but the type ID is used more for runtime because you can basically store the type. You can store this type, it's a type info object, and you can store it in a class or whatever. And so you use type ID for dynamic polymorphism. I just wanted to show you exactly how it works, because you always see me using this to identify the types that I have, and you just get these characters or this like short names for the things. Then we saw, I just wanna make sure the thing with the assert came over right. Let's say we have some double, and it should be a probability. And now this read function just basically takes input from the command line. You see how it works right in a second. And now I just want to make sure that my probability stays between 0 and 1, because otherwise, I mean, it makes no sense, right? Because I assume that this is a probability. So if I run this, please enter a number, I enter 12, well, fail, because it's not between 0 and 1. And here I get the nice, as you want to see it, but it's still nice enough. It says me, it tells me the line, and it says the assertion, and then exactly what assertion that failed. And so I can now go back to line 49 here. Oh, well, it failed, right? So it's quite handy. And as I told you, you can get rid of the assertions if you use DN debug. Or at least under GCC 4.7, it's DN debug, but I think that's global. And now, I mean, the assertion is still there, right? I type 12, nothing happens. So in case you ever write code for a nuclear power plant, please don't use asserts, use an actual error. And because you want to, like, if something goes south, you want to catch an error and, like, initialize the shutdown procedure or whatever, right? You don't want to just say, well, you can go and make my probabilities minus 20. I don't care, because things can go horribly wrong then, right? And so if it's critical to know when it fails, you use an actual error. And it looks quite similar. It just says it was terminated after throwing an instance of standard runtime error. And then it tells me what, and here is my message that I have in the error. It just tells me P must be between 0 and 1. And yeah, that's basically the use asserts for.
Asserts don't do a core dump, do they?
No, they don't throw. They just like stop the program. They just stop it there. You cannot catch an assert. If an assertion fails, you cannot do it like a catch or something. And yeah, so basically asserts for like if you build your code, if you like want to make sure everything works out, and if everything works and you don't need the checks anymore, you can just leave them out with DN debug. Then we went through the static asserts. I don't comment this anymore. It's quite easy. So just a static assert and then the condition and the error. So basically, if I put this to false, well, it doesn't compile and error some nice message. Sorry? Yeah, exactly. I have here the example. If you have a bool and then you want to take the bool from the standard input and then do a static assert on this bool, forget it, because it's not compile time. It has to be a constant expression. That's right. Then the what we also saw last time is the how a template class works. Just this keyword template followed by whatever parameters you want. And this was our like array wrap. It basically just contains this array and it throws us it has an assert if you are out of the interval. And just to show you how a template works with default arguments, I have it here. So it's just it's exactly the same. You just type your T and then equal to whatever you want. And so in the end, you can, so this is just our normal template that we had in example 2.3, I think. And this is just the default template. You can either call it with zero arguments. You still need these two brackets. I'll also explain that in a second. And you can call it either with one, two, or three, however you want, because you have defaults. Then we saw the template functions. They also take the keyword and then the function. And if you have something related to T in here, it can deduce the type. You don't have to give the or to write down the angular bracket. And so here we have an integer, a double, and a string. And you can just do print I, print S, print D. Or you can say, well, I want my double printed in an integer way. And so in the end, how this looks is just, well, my string, my double, and now my double printed is an integer. And that's how it works. And
it's passing the double into the integer.
Exactly. You basically tell the function, well, you are now a function that takes an integer. And then you pass a double, and it gets converted to integer and like loses the stuff after the decimal point. And here it's you have a second template. It's quite nice because you have you have two types. This is this mean that I showed you also before, but in a little different style. And the return type, you basically have to tell the function what its return type is. There is no way the compiler can deduce the return type like this. I'll show you how it's done, but you have to calculate the return type. And so the nice thing is you only have to pass one argument. Basically, you only have to pass R because T is deducible. I mean, the compiler can guess what T is.
So you have to put R first in template.
There you go. Exactly. That's exactly the point. If you don't do it, if you change R and T, you have to give both because, as again, R cannot be deduced. And I'll show you here how it works. You have two arguments, both integers, and you tell the compiler, well, the return type is a double. And so in the end, we get 1.5. Any questions so far? This was just a recap from last time. And then the last point, I wasn't quite happy how I explained to you why the template deduction or the type deduction doesn't work for constructors, so I did a little digging there. And so normally if you have a template, this is the standard pair. It's just a template that takes two types and it stores these two elements, just what the pair does. And so I have here a pair of int and int, p1, and again, just initialize it with 1 and 2. And now, why doesn't standard pair without like parameters and these two guys work? Because as you like figured, it shouldn't be hard for the compiler to guess what the types are. And actually, you can do a little workaround. You can have a function that takes two types. I just call the function make pair. The function returns a pair, and it takes these two guys. And now the function can deduce the types, and then it returns just my pair with T and U.
So you just wrap it basically.
Exactly. That's exactly what you do. But now, why can't you do it with the constructor? And the guy that invented C++, I don't even try to pronounce the name because I probably mess up horribly. This is from his book. And he basically just says the reason is the flexibility provided by several constructors for a class would make a deduction impossible. In the many cases, even obscure what's exactly going on. That's why it's a design choice, or it's a choice that it's not possible to deduce class parameters, class template parameters. And he states further, if we need basically an object that deduces a type, please use a function for the creation like makePair. So makePair, actually, I just implemented it here to show you, but makePair is part of the standard, so you can just use the standard makePair, like I showed on here. Yeah, exactly here. You can just use standard makePair. You don't need to implement this yourself. And that's how you can deduce like class parameters if you really want it, or if you need to use it a lot. And it's quite helpful if you have temporaries like here, where you just have a temporary object and you want to pass it to a function. This is quite some writing here, because you have to write the type, you have to write the parameters, and you have to write the initialize. And this is quite way nicer to write. And it just does exactly the same job.
So you can put the wrappers inside the class separation,
right? This function.
Yeah, the wrappers.
No, they are external. They are not in the function. No, because then again, you would need the types to access the class to get this function.
No, but I mean, they have their own template command right above. Because you showed that once before, right? You have, in a class, you can have the keyword template again.
Yeah, yeah.
The other functions of the class.
But the problem is, if you have here, let's say we have our partner pair, and now you want to move this guy inside the pair, right?
Well, you would use TU.
Yeah, you wouldn't use TU, you're right. But now the problem is, how do you access this function? To access the function, you have to make pair scope, right? Do you see the problem? You have to make pair, and then you have to have some types, and then you can get the make pair. You see? There's your problem. So that's why it's external. Because otherwise, you cannot access it. You could like do default parameters and then just say, well, I call it like this, but still, it's not really clear what it does, and the benefit of having it inside the class aren't that big. So that's why it's not done like that. And now just a side note for C++ 11, why it is awesome. You have this keyword auto, and it basically deduces the type from the function or from whatever is on the other side. So we have this standard make pair, and it takes a double in the string. And then auto knows that the thing that comes back is a pair of double and string. So you actually never have to write this standard pair of double and string. And that's quite nice about C++ 11. And it's not, I mean, P2 is really this pair of double and string. It's nothing strange. It's just you don't have to write it anymore. You can just leave out this long definition. Sorry?
How generic is auto? Can I go auto P2 equals 4 for fundamental types?
Yeah, sure.
It's just a general type deducing.
Yeah. No problem. You see? Works perfectly fine. Yeah, I mean, it's really not hard for the compiler to get what's over here. I mean, since it's strongly typed, the compiler always knows what guys are what types.
So I guess my non-C++ 11 compiler won't compile this example. So auto is a new keyword.
Yeah, exactly. And also, probably state it up here. I normally state it if something needs C++ 11, I state it up here. So if you see this, you either have to comment the C++ 11 stuff, or you need the C++ 11 compiler. So this was just a like summary from last time, or just going over it again. Is everything clear so far?
Good.
Well then, let's go on to the mean function. Again, this mean function is just takes two numbers, divides it by a double, nothing fancy, and returns it. And the challenge here is, how do I get the return type? How do I know what should come back? Because for integer, it's a double. For double, it's a double, right? And that's exactly what I'm going to show you how to do. So I have one. We start off just with normal functions. There are no templates in this example. We have just this mean function. It takes two integers, and then it returns a double. It's just a handwritten class, right? And it just does this calculation that we want to have. And again, I inline it because it's such a small calculation. I don't need a function call for this. And also the compiler decides on its own. If you write inline, it doesn't get inlined automatically. If you have a huge function, you do inline, the compiler says, nah, I don't do it. He has the compiler has the right to do it. So it's just you allow inlining. And also if you do aggressive optimization, even if you don't put inline, the compiler will inline. So
basically just not.
Yeah, it's a recommendation. Where you really need it is if you have, again, if you have destruction of structure of header and separate a file, where you have the declaration in the header and the definition in the file, the compiler cannot inline that. Because the compiler has no clue what a print function does if you don't like tell the compiler what it actually does, the definition, right? So there, the compiler has no chance there to inline.
Well, except if you use clang.
Sorry?
If you use clang, clang.
Yeah.
The C compiler. That can inline even in these cases.
Yeah, but then it's operations on binary level. That's after compiled. Probably does some optimization where it knows, well, I have a function call to something in this O file, and then it goes over there and copies the execution code.
Yeah, so that's a great object file, they call it bytecode.
Yeah.
And when you link, then the bytecode is compiled.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. But it's...
In this case, it doesn't matter whether it's headers or whether it's...
Yeah, but... Yeah, exactly. But that's basically an optimization that the compiler or the vendor of the compiler does for you, and it has basically nothing to do with C++ standard. I mean, it's just a very clever thing to do. So you basically can still do like this object separated stuff and still have the benefit of everything getting inline.
You can even inline C function in the C++, so C++ is the forefront function.
Yeah. So if I call this mean function, it does exactly what we want. 1 and 2, it's 1.5, right? And now if I do it with 1.8 and 2, you guys guess what happens? Well, it's obviously again 1.5. Why? Because we pass doubles and they get converted to integers, and 1.8 gets converted to a 1, and then it does the mean between 1 and 2. So that's wrong, right? We don't want to have that. So how can we get around that? Well, we just write a mean function that takes two doubles. And this works because of function overloading. I mean, you have two functions that have the same name, but due to function overloading, it works. So now 1.9, perfect. Now, who knows what happens if I...
No one is, or maybe throw a warning, you're saying the wrong type. But like, I double converted or something?
No, before, if I didn't have this, if I don't have this,
yeah.
No. It probably, I mean, because a double is convertible to an integer. And so it does it. Probably you can enable something. I'm not sure.
I get those warnings. It depends on the parameter, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, probably C-Lang would tell you that you have, C-Lang would probably tell you that you convert a double to an integer and that you should pay attention. C-Lang does way nicer error messaging. So if you have some code and you don't get it to work, compile it with C-Lang and you will get nicer error messages. So, but back to the example, what happens now if I call mean with a long double? Who can guess? Well, what is wrong here? Oh, I already compiled it. So you don't have to answer. The problem is here, it's ambiguous. So it doesn't know which function to take because the long double is convertible to a double and it's convertible to an integer. And so a compiler doesn't like it because, well, it doesn't know what to do. And you basically had to have a heuristic that chooses whatever the compiler thinks it's best, but it's your job as a programmer to make sure the right code gets picked. And so how can we avoid that? Well, one solution would be to just get rid of the integer function. Now everything works. We get the right results, and the double function is chosen for all three. So seems like a good idea, but it actually isn't. Because of the following, you probably can guess why. An integer is 4 bytes long, a double is 8, and the long double is 16. So if we now do the mean with the integer, you have first to convert the integer to a double, then do the more expensive addition with two double types, and then convert it back to an it remains in double, right? But you basically waste runtime here because you have to do all this conversion. And it's even worse in the long double case, because the long double gets converted to a double, and there you actually make mistakes because you lose precision. You cut off like half of the precision, and then you do the calculation, and in the end you just convert it to a double, and probably you wanted to have a long double. So that's not the way to go. And I hope this reminds you of the, or again, how could we fix this? Well, we could just write another function that takes a long double. Now everything works, right? But the problem again is you have to write for every type a function, and you still have, if you have like a new type, you have problems with ambiguity and all this kind of stuff. And I hope this reminds you of this template or this example at the beginning where we had the double five class, the double int class, the whatever. So this is really a case for templates. And now we go to the first attempt. Here I just have a template. It takes two types T, returns a type T. And yeah, I didn't change the code in the main. And now let's see what happens. Well, the mean between one of and two is obviously one, right? Then 1.9 and 1.9. It basically works for the floating types, but it doesn't for the integer. Why? Because mean of int has an integer as a return type. And we don't want to have that, because then, since the mean of two integers is not necessarily a mean. That's the problem here. So
the return type is, when you say inline t?
Yeah, exactly. The return type is the same as the arguments that come in. And if you feed the function integers, it will return an integer. And you basically lose the precision there. That's why we get a 1 here, because it's 1.5, and the return type is an integer, and then it gets converted to an integer, and you lose the 0.5. So that's obviously not the way to go, but it's quite close, because it works for all the floating types. It'll work, right? Because they have the floating, they have the right properties. For integer, for all the integer types, it doesn't.
Well, assuming the arguments are the same.
Yeah, in this example, I always assume these two things are the same. In the example I showed you in the beginning, you can have different ones. So I just do it to keep it a little more simple, but the principles are the same, and you can look up the code in one, one, two, and yeah, here you have the code for this mean function that takes two. So here my mean function, this is just my type. Here it takes a T and a U, two types. So if you're interested, you can, after this chapter 4, you can just look up that example to see how it works. So, and now we go really into the template stuff. How can we get around this problem? So, what we basically want, we want to have some kind of function, like, I don't know, let's call it getType. And we want to feed this function a type. This is just meta code. This is not legal C++ what I write here. And then we want to ask if t equal integer, please return double. And in any other case, return t, right? So it basically just says, if you encounter an integer, please return me a double. Otherwise, return me t again. And you can implement this like this. The only thing that changed for the mean function is this return type. It's not t anymore. It's called mean trait of t. And this mean trait calculates this return type. Or the mean trait does exactly this. So basically, get type is the same as mean trait. And it looks a little strange with all this type name and type around. But that's exactly how you have to work at compile time. So basically, your arguments, if you have some arguments, you have to put them in a bracket. And if you want to have some return, you have to write it like this. Type name, whatever, scope, type. This is how you return stuff. And that's exactly what I'm doing here. This type name and the type just serve the purpose of returning whatever mean trait calculates.
It's only because mean trait type is a type.
Exactly. If the, again, if we had an integer here, you can get rid of type name.
Yeah. But type isn't a keyword, it's just the name of the variable
t. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Type, and that this is convention that you write type here. You could write whatever you wanted here. I mean, as long as it's, or no, that's not legal, but whatever you want. But then you have to have the same in the function that gives it back. But it's convention to write type, and I would recommend doing so because everybody does it. And you can always, you only return, or you normally return one, and yeah. But you can get creative with this stuff.
Just, it's not a keyword.
Yeah. No, no, type is, it just, it in my editor, it becomes blue because I do a type def. And then it knows this, like, word has to be handled like a type. That's the only way why my editor colors it blue. The mean trait, it just says, well, you give me a T, I give you a T back. But now that's like the else part, right? Whatever you give me, I return it. And how can we do an if? And here, we see something that's called the full specialization. We write template without anything in it, and then we say struct again, and again exactly the same as here. And the argument here is integer. So it basically means whenever you need a mean trait, use this, except when it's integer. Please use my specialization that I wrote for integer. And so you can see in the specialization, I write double as a type. And so that's exactly, that's how you handle ifs. You have to do a specialization and the compiler will take, the compiler will always prefer a specialization over the generic template or the main template. I mean, because you went through the trouble to write the specific implementation for a certain type.
So what tells compiler
This is just because we don't have, exactly, this is a full specialization. You have to write this just to tell the compiler, well, mean trait is still a template.
So
you just specialize it. Yeah, I come to that in a second. You can do exactly that. And now in the end, if we have again our example here, we have int, works well, we get 1.5. We have double, works perfectly fine. We have this E just means long double. Again, these characters are a bit cryptic. But now what happens if I take an unsigned integer? Any guesses? Well, it fails. Because I only specialized it for integers. I didn't tell the compiler what to do if it encounters an unsigned integer. And that's exactly the problem. You need to make a specialization for every integer type you see. And yeah, we don't do that. And so now that was the second attempt. Are there any questions so far? It's really important that you like get this specialization and this like concept of operating on types. And that's exactly what you do during compile time. The only thing you can do is operating on types. And that this is how you do it. So if there aren't any questions, I will go on to the last example. Now, what I do in this example is basically the following. Again, I write just this pseudocode so you get a hang of what I'm trying to do. Use double. I want it to return a bool. And it basically, it has to figure out somehow if t is a type that needs a double or if t is a type that needs t. So what I expect this function to do if t somehow needs double, please return true. And if it doesn't, it should return false. Right. So for a long double, if you ask, does a long double need the double as a return type? The answer is no. A long double is its own return type. And that's exactly what I want to have. I want to have this function. And then I want to have a second one. I want to have an if. Again, I want to have the trait. And I want to insert in the trait somehow use bool, then the type, these two guys I want to insert. And again, double. Thank you. And if use double, return double, and else return T. Basically, the only thing that changed, now we have this condition. We don't check if T is integer. We check if the type needs, and yeah, I could also get rid of this USD here and just put it like this, right? I call this function over there. And that's what we want to do. We want to just somehow figure out if the type that we insert, if it needs a double as a return type. And this part here is how you do it. Now I go through here step by step. The important part is this guy only exists during compile time. You cannot have like members. The only thing you can have in there is static stuff and yeah, enumerations and basically stuff that goes on during compile time. You cannot have, and you also, you basically never have an object of this type. You never, in your code, you never have something like use type. I mean, you could, but that's not the idea. You never write something like this, never, ever, ever.
And if you don't write it, it'll never get.
Exactly. This guy doesn't exist in your final code. It just does the operation, it just does the calculation of the return type. Yeah, because you only want to have functions that can work without having an actual object. And the normal member function only works if you have an object calling it, right? Because if I have if I have a member, you have to call it like this. And if you have a static function, you can call it like this without having a type. That's why all this stuff is static. And you can also see a little hint why this stuff isn't in the actual code. You see, I don't provide any declaration. It's just we have some function check, but I don't say what it does. And you don't need to, because in the end, it's not in the code. It just does the method template stuff. So how exactly do we do this? Here, I have a static variable of my type. And then I perform this computation here, t plus t divided by double 1 or double 2, whatever you want. We are not interested in the result. We are interested in the result type. So I could also write here 0.1. Doesn't really matter. The important part is that that object below the thing is a double type. What it is doesn't really matter. You can compute this. And this happens during compile time. And now this guy has the right type. I mean, if we perform this, the result here will have the right type. If we have two integers, this construction will be a double. If we have two doubles, this construction will be a double. If we have two long doubles, this thing will be a long double. The only thing we have to do now is to get the type out, right? So can you follow, do you follow me so far that when I pretend that the type of that, what I marked right there, has the type that we are interested in?
Why do you check?
That's how I extract the type. So again, this guy is either double or the type. For like long double, it's long double.
Yes.
And for integer types, it's a double, right?
Yes.
So now I use overload. If it's long double, this will be a long double. Then it will select this check, this first check, because it's long double. And this first check returns a character. And now all I do is I ask, is the size of this check the same as the size of a double? So basically what I ask here is, did you choose check this check, or did you use this check?
And it happens during compile time?
Yeah, everything.
Well, it's just overloading, right? The check doesn't do anything.
No, check doesn't actually do anything. The compiler has to figure out which check to use, right? And after it figured out this, it knows what the result type of check is. It's either a character or a double. And now here comes the size of.
Using the tag of the return is the integer. What's the size of it? Like, how does it know the size of it unless it's actually dummy code? It knows the type.
Yeah, that's exactly why size of is awesome. You can provide size of with a type. You don't have to provide it with an actual object.
But I thought size of was called during runtime.
No, that's type ID. Yeah, type ID is runtime, but size of is fully compile time. So you have whatever you want here, And either it's the type, the actual type that you inserted, or it's a double.
So how do you know when, how do you know that it's compile time? Like how do you know? How do we know which ones? Which
you can take a look at the assembly or whatever, and you will never see this function anywhere. You can do like write this, call it for an integer, and do a handwritten class and compile it and compare the sizes of the binary, for example. And if it's like exactly the same size, it does exactly the same as a handwritten code, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, so that's one way you could check it.
But I mean, like, you know size of this rendering code. What other functions?
Yeah, I always thought size of this runtime.
No.
You know size of this code.
Because all the types and the, like, this, what sizes the types have, it's known during compile time. It's not like a program asks you, well, what size should an integer be when you start it? I mean, that's determined by your machine and your compiler. That's not something you can choose during runtime, right? You can only specify if you want an int32 or an int64 or whatever. But you cannot say, well, now my standard integer has to change size. That's not going to happen during runtime.
So everything in here has to be compile time.
Yeah, exactly. So again, you have the type that you're interested. You put it into check. Check works via overload.
Oh.
And so basically, if we insert an integer, it will choose the second one. And size of this double is obviously the same as double, and that's why we get true. So the value in the end is true for everything that needs a double and not itself.
So what's enum do?
Enum, yeah, it's basically you. I cannot store. I could probably also do. The problem is you have to store the information somehow during compile time, and you cannot use a normal constant value because you can read them only during runtime. And also, if I had a constant rule, again, I would need an actual object to get to this V, right? But now you could argue, let's make the static. Another problem is with static variables, you have to initialize them outside of the class. I think you could do a version where you don't need an enum, but a static constant. I think that I could see how that would work. But It's the most convenient way to just say, well, we have an enum, and it has a one member value, and this guy is either true or false, and that's determined by this huge thing over there. So this is quite confusing at the first time if you see it. It's actual.
So
actually, it's not.
In general.
Sorry.
What does enum do in general? I've never even seen it encountered.
You don't know what enum does?
You know, it's like a list of iterators.
No. Enum, classically, you need it for... It's the only thing that helps make the program more readable. So...
I think it's just like being a list.
You would use it like this. You would say, well, these are my options, and let's... You can actually call this thing something. You don't have to. So we have an enum caller, and it has these three elements. And now I could have a function that takes a caller, C. And this basically forces the user to use one of these three like names. You cannot put in, so if I call function, I cannot do this. I have to write here red. Or a green or blue or whatever.
So red becomes a keyword? It's an odd sense.
You can see it as a class. See it as a class color that has a lot of static constants in there. It has a static constant red, it has a static constant blue, it has a static constant green. That's basically how it works. But yeah, don't worry, it's basically that's the easiest step to store it in the enum. The harder part is this like yeah, I could call this whatever, but it doesn't really matter. Yeah, exactly. The only thing I need is value. And again, if you have some return types that aren't types, you call them value. That's also like some sort of convention. But I could call this whatever I want, right? Because it's just the enum keyword, or one member of the enum. So, but again, this is not difficult, it's just different. You have to get used to this strange notation. But the only thing it does, it takes a T, it checks if it needs a double or a T, and then it returns true or false if it needs a double. And quite an important part is we have to do a full specialization for an actual double. The reason is if we have a double, this T will be a double, and you probably see why this fails. Because you have two functions that take exactly the same thing. And then the compiler has no clue which function to use, right? I mean,
do you use a template instead?
Sorry?
Do you use a template instead?
Yeah, but you always run the same ambiguity problem. Because, I mean, you could, you wanted to use a template here for a static template, or?
Yes, like that.
But then you still have to.
But then again, you have to have some sort of, you could use some, yeah. Yes. Yeah, you can also specialize. I see how that you could do a template here inside, and then do a specialization for double in there.
Yeah,
that could work too. But this is normally it's a bit clearer for me, or at least in my opinion, that if you have you basically specialize it and say use double identifier for double, well, use double for double, true. Well, we want to use a double for double. But it actually doesn't matter. We could also say false. Don't use double, use the type that we inserted. And this type is a double. So it's going to use double either way. Because it's like, if use double, return double, else return double. Right? So it doesn't matter what we write here. And now the if, and here we have, again, we have a template that takes a condition. And it takes some type that is returned in case of true, and some type that is returned in case of false. And we just say, in the default case, we return the true type, T. And now we do, again, a specialization, but this time it's not a full, it's a partial specialization. We still want to have T and F templated. And so we write a template of T and F, and you see here, I write we specialize it for the bool. We say, now if bool is false, please use this guy. And T and F can be whatever. And so we return the false type in case the condition is false. Can you see how this works? You can also say, well, in the general type, I do nothing. And you specialize it for both. You specialize it for true and false. That's also perfectly fine. And then in the end, this is our better mean trait. Looks quite horribly. I tried to like format it a bit nicer. We type def something to type. This something is, again, type name and type we only use to like return. And what we want to return is our meta if. And if this guy here is true, please give us a double. Otherwise, give us a T. That's how it works. And now the template third attempt has only this guy here as a type. And again, type name and type we use for return. And this better mean trait actually calculates the return type. And it looks horribly troublesome to go through all this kind of trouble to have this mean function. But the nice thing is you have to do this once and you are done forever. And I show you, let me show first. Use double identifier for an integer, it says, yes, we need a double. For a double, it says, yeah, well, we also need a double. For an unsigned integer, it tells me again, yeah, we need a double. And for a long double, it says, nope, we don't need a double, we need long double. And now I call it with different types. Here, I have an integer, well, 1.5, perfectly fine. I have a double, works fine. Long double, perfectly fine. Unsigned integer, no problem. Long integer, what is it? Unsigned long. And it works for all the types now because it can calculate the return type with this trait. And that's what you call it. You call them traits. And that's, I had to write this once, and I can now insert all types I want.
Are you sure that it used long double as a return type for long double?
Yeah, you can check that, no problem. Here, long double. You're not sure if it's a long double, right?
No. Long double. That's long unsigned.
Ah. Yeah, sure.
Or that's the only case where it doesn't use double, so you want to actually check that.
Type ID E. See, you see, you have an E here, not a D. D would be double, E is long double. So that's how you know that it actually did the right thing, right? But you also can guess it here, because for the long double up here, it says it's false. So it will use the actual type in this if construction. And the really, really important part is we use concepts here, and we don't use types. We are not interested how a type is called. We are interested what a type can do. That's the important part. This mean, this entire mean function only relies on you guys have to have an operation plus and the division by a double. And that's all the type has to have. The mean function doesn't care how the type is called or anything name related. It only relies on the concept. And
size of.
Yeah, but size of is not. It's only, it's merely a tool. It's nothing critical. It's just, this is just a technicality. How I mean, I know as soon as I did this, I know the type. All these shenanigans with overloading and size off and all this fancy stuff, it's merely to get the type back. That's like the only purpose of that. It doesn't have to do anything with calculating the actual type. It's just
actually the return type of check doesn't have to be double. You can just character short.
Yeah, sure. The important part is that they have different sizes. I normally do a small template that takes an integer like integer n the struct. Yeah, you see it's actually highlighted because I use it all the time. And the thing I have in here is I have some character a of n. And so I can basically say size of char array 5 is actually 5. And the size of 6 will be 6. So that's how you can differentiate like 1,000 cases if you want. And again, this A will never be around during runtime because you never have an object called char array. It's merely the type. That's how you can make it a little neater instead of just using char and double. But if you have two, you can pick two types where you are actually sure that they're different. But again, if you had like some scumbag compiler where a double is 1 byte, yeah, you run into trouble with this, but yeah, where on what compiler is a double 1 byte, right? So this is how you use the concept, and I already run out of time, but I show you here how an actual concept works. This is straight off this out of this library that I worked 2 years on. So I call this guy, and it does exactly the same thing that we saw right now with this mean function. I call it mean value type concept. And then the way you state it is you say, well, M is a model of mean value type concept. That basically means an integer, for example. An integer is a model of this. And M1 and M2 are objects of type M. So that basically means an integer A and an integer B, or an integer M1 and M2. And so you basically state whatever your assertions are, and then you say what are legal expressions. What do you have to be able to do with the type? And you see here I want to have a default constructor, I want to have an integer constructor, I want to have a copy constructor, I want to have addition, I want to have multiplication, I want to have a division, an equal operator, plus equal, and a streamer operator. And in the end, everything that fulfills this concept can be used in like some function that I wrote. Because this function just assumes that the type has this capabilities. And that's exactly how you like go away from using actual names and start using concepts, where you don't care how stuff is called, you care about what the stuff can do. And for example, here I have my error value type concept, and it's quite nice. It's exactly like a derivation. You can derive, you call it refinement. I just say, well, basically my error value type concept can do exactly the same thing or exactly the same stuff as my mean value type concept. But it also has to have subtraction and the square root, right? So you don't have actually to write all the functionality you want all the time. You can just say, well, this is like even better than this concept, or it needs even more than this concept, if you want it like that. And yeah, that's kind of the way how modern libraries are written. Also, the standard template library relies heavily on this concept thing, and also the Boost libraries, all concepts are all over the place, because in the end, Boost writes some code, and it states it works for this concept. And if you can write your own class, your own whatever, perfectly custom thing, as long as it fulfills the concept, you can use like high-speed search algorithms and sort algorithms or whatever. And that's exactly it's not actually called concept programming, but it's just the generic programming with a usage of concepts. I think we saved the last part for Friday, since it's already 1 hour. Yeah, but the 6 is just a really short one. 6 and 7, they are basically short. The last point is 5. And then you basically have seen everything you can do with templates so far in this standard.
Okay, so I put the room for the same time on Friday. Does that work?
Sure.